You'll turn with me again, please, to Romans chapter 13 and verses 1 to 7. Now, this passage is a reminder, I think, of what a well-rounded Christian the Apostle Paul was. The fact that in the very same letter in which he gives us probably the Bible's most comprehensive treatment of justification by faith, and probably the Bible's most comprehensive treatment of union with Christ, and probably the Bible's most comprehensive treatment of future glorification, he also gives us here in these verses probably the Bible's most comprehensive treatment of the role of civil government and the Christian's relationship to it. I recently heard a Christian speaker who had been brought up in an unbelieving home and converted as an adult. And having been converted, he was very intrigued one day to discover that many years earlier, his parents, who, as I say, were unbelievers, they weren't Christians, his parents had had dinner in the home of Michael Green. Some of you will have heard of Michael Green, maybe read his books. He's a veteran Christian evangelist based in Oxford. And as I say then, this chap was very intrigued to discover that his parents had had a meal in Michael Green's home. And he sought, therefore, to, as delicately as possible, question his parents about this occasion. And he wanted to find out, really, whether or not, to any degree at all, Michael Green had been able to explain the gospel to his parents during that meal, whether this famed evangelist had managed to find an opportunity to sow some seeds in his parents' hearts. And he was very disappointed, therefore, when his mother said to him that the only thing she really remembered about the occasion was the way in which Michael Green carved the meat. He carved the meat, she said, with immense dignity. Well, anyway, sometime later, this chap actually met Michael Green for himself. And so he told him this story, and he said, well, many years ago, my parents, they had dinner at your home. And it's very strange, because the one thing that my mother can remember is the way in which you carved the meat. She says that you carved the meat with great dignity. And immediately, quick as a flash and in total seriousness, Michael Green responded, well, I suppose I would. That animal gave its life for me. And he was very struck by that, this chap, that here's this great evangelist who travels all around the world speaking at Christian missions and Christian crusades. And yet, you see, he's more than just a passionate preacher of John 3:16. Of course, he is that. But here's a man whose Christian worldview permeates every area of his life, so that not only has he thought deeply about the cross of Christ and the offer of the gospel, but he has also thought deeply about the importance of God's creation and man's proper stewardship of it, so that it was even reflected in the way in which he carved a joint of meat. And the Apostle Paul was a bit like that, you see. Yes, of course, he had thought deeply about the cross of Jesus Christ. You only have to read chapter 3 of this epistle, or chapter 5 of this epistle, to see that. And of course, for Paul, we must insist the cross was the most important thing of all. It was the very center point. It was in that in which he boasted. But Paul had also thought deeply about a whole load of other things, including how, as Christians, we ought to view our civil leaders and our civil rulers. And it's that which he comes to deal with now then, here at the beginning of chapter 13. And I think that there are at least three reasons why he deals with this matter here specifically. The first very obvious reason is that, as we've said before, in this whole section of Romans, Paul is dealing with Christian ethics, Christian living, how it is that we ought to live in this world. And of course, you can't live in this world for very long without confronting the reality of its prevailing authorities. Government necessarily impinges upon all of us all of the time. And so it's very appropriate and it's very natural that in amongst his consideration of gifts and in amongst his consideration of love And in amongst his consideration of various other very practical day-to-day matters, Paul should also consider this matter of civil government. But then another reason why I think he deals with the matter here specifically is in order to avoid a misapplication of something he has said in chapter 12. You remember how in the first two verses of chapter 12, he's given a kind of general introduction to this whole ethical section. And he says in verse 2 of chapter 12, "Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world." And we said at the time when we were looking at that verse that Paul means don't be mindlessly swept along. Don't mindlessly do things simply because that's what everyone else is doing. Of course, in many areas of life, there will be points of similarity with the conduct of the unbelieving world around us, won't there? We often will eat the same food that unbelievers eat. We often will use the same banks that unbelievers use. We often will live in the same kinds of houses that unbelievers live in. But the point is that we don't do any of those things. We don't do anything simply because that's what everyone else is doing. We don't just get swept along. This is the latest fad. This is the latest trend. Therefore, I am going to do it that way too. That's what Paul is talking about there in chapter 12, verse 2. But Paul is aware, you see, that some might interpret what he says there in a much more simplistic fashion, as though Paul were saying that as Christians we ought to disengage altogether from this world. We ought to withdraw completely. We ought to basically opt out of society, becoming a kind of monastic fringe, breathing this world's oxygen perhaps, but not really getting any more involved than that. Because, of course, we are citizens of heaven. Our citizenship is in heaven, and we, therefore, are holding out for the next world. And Paul, therefore, is very anxious, I think, to avoid that particular misapplication. Because the fact is, you see, that as Christians, we have dual citizenship, don't we? Yes, of course, we are citizens of heaven. United with Jesus Christ, already we are seated with him in the heavenly realms, and we are earnestly looking forward to the passing away of this world and the inauguration of the new one. That we must insist upon emphatically, and that, of course, is our most basic citizenship. But we are also citizens of this world, and we must not, therefore, become a monastic fringe. We must responsibly engage with this world. We must responsibly engage with its work, its employment. As Christians, we must contribute to the turning of the wheels of industry, as Mike brought out so clearly from 1 Thessalonians a couple of weeks ago. And we must responsibly engage, too, with its authority structures. And that's why, then, I think, or one reason why, Paul moves on to deal with that now at the beginning of chapter 13. It's part of his countering this impulse to renounce everything to do with this world. Renouncing all this world's institutions, all this world's structures. No, Paul says, we don't do that. And here's one example of how we don't do that in our relationship to the civil government. Then a third reason why he deals with this matter here specifically is to wrap up what he's been saying at the end of chapter 12. Because at the end of chapter 12, he's been talking, hasn't he, about the importance of loving one's enemies. We saw that last time a few weeks ago. And in particular, he's been talking about the absolute unacceptableness of revenge, of seeking revenge against our enemies. And do you remember the specific argument that he uses in verse 19 of chapter 12? "Do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, 'It is mine to avenge, I will repay,' says the Lord." In other words, Paul is saying that one reason why revenge is so inherently unacceptable is because in seeking it, we are effectively trying to shove God off his throne and usurp his prerogative. Because you see, administering wrath and retribution and punishment on our enemies is his business. He sees to those things. But that raises the question, doesn't it? How does he do that? How does God avenge our enemies? How does God administer this wrath and retribution and punishment on our enemies, those who have wronged us? Well, part of the answer to that, of course, is back in chapter 2 and verse 5 of this epistle, where Paul talks about the day of God's wrath. And there, of course, supremely on that final day of judgment in the future, there, in a very full and a very final way, our enemies will be avenged by God, and he will administer wrath and retribution and punishment, unless, of course, and this is what we should want more than anything, unless our enemies have fled to him in repentance and faith, in which case the wrath and the punishment fell on Jesus Christ, the substitute, at Calvary's cross 2,000 years ago. So that's the main answer. How does God avenge our enemies on that great future day that's coming? But Paul wants to add now in these opening verses of chapter 13. Also, even now, in this present age, sometimes God does avenge our enemies. Sometimes God does administer wrath upon our enemies. Because if they have wronged us seriously, and if they have violated the laws of the land in doing so, then they will, of course, be convicted and sentenced by the state. And the state, Paul says quite explicitly at the end of verse 4, is God's servant, an agent of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. So sometimes, Paul is saying, not always, but sometimes, God avenges our enemies even now, before the final day of judgment comes. And he does it through the state, through the civil magistrate, through them punishing wrongdoers. Back in August 1997, Michael Pollard, an evangelical minister from West Yorkshire, was out administering aid in Hungary. And one night on a quiet road north of Budapest, the camper van in which he and his wife Jo were sleeping was targeted by three robbers. And Michael Pollard was hit around the head several times with an iron bar and died. His wife, Jo, who's lying next to him, was seriously injured. The men were subsequently arrested and imprisoned. But a year later, in August 1998, Jo Pollard went back to Hungary, and she visited the men in prison who had killed her husband. She visited their families as well. And she expressed to them her forgiveness, that she forgave them for what they had done to her husband. And she spoke to them about the Lord Jesus Christ. And there in that little anecdote, you have Romans 12 and 13 in action, don't you? Jo Pollard, for her part, forgiving those men, repaying their evil with kindness, as instructed at the end of Romans 12. God, for his part, punishing those men through the Hungarian justice system, as indicated in the first part of Romans 13. So those are three reasons then why we have this passage here specifically, I think, because it fits with the ethical theme of this whole section, because it's avoiding and countering a possible misapplication of what he said in verse 2 of chapter 12, and in order to wrap up what he said at the end of chapter 12. But I'm just going to go through these verses very quickly and then comment really by way of relevance to us at the end. So just very quickly, I'm going to look at these verses under three headings. First of all, divine appointment. Divine appointment in verses 1 and 2. Paul says, everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, and literally, for there is no authority except by God, and the authorities that exist have been appointed by God. Now, Paul is effectively here answering two questions. First question, who is it that appoints governments? Who is it that appoints governments? And Paul's answer is God. Ultimately, it's God. It's not the people who are being governed. It's not the government that appoints itself. But there is no authority, he says, except by God. It's God, ultimately, who appoints governments. But then, second question. Which governments are those appointed by God? How do we know whether or not a particular government has been appointed by him? What is the decisive criterion? Is it only right-wing governments that have been appointed by God? Is it only left-wing governments that have been appointed by God? Is it only democratic governments that have been appointed by God? Which ones is it? And Paul's answer in the last part of verse 1 is the authorities that exist, or as the AV renders it so much more memorably, the powers that be. It's the powers that be that have been appointed by God. In other words, Paul is saying that if a government is in power, if a government is governing, then regardless of anything else, regardless of its agenda, regardless of its policies, regardless of its ideology, regardless of its moral tone, that government has been appointed by God. Simply being the government is the only criterion. And so he concludes very logically then in verse 2 that anyone therefore who defies the government, anyone who breaks the government's laws, anyone who resists the state in its laws and precepts and commands, whatever that government, anyone who resists government per se, is resisting God's appointment. It's like if you're parents and you go out for the evening and so you ask the next door neighbor to come and babysit. And you go away, have a lovely evening. You come back at the end of the evening only to discover that your four-year-old son has been an absolute nightmare. He's been a pain in the neck. And he has refused to turn off the television when told. He's refused to go to bed when told. He's basically refused to comply with every single instruction. Well, you're not going to just laugh at you and say, oh, don't worry about it, son. She was only a babysitter. You didn't need to listen to her. She was just the next door neighbor coming in and babysitting. Don't worry about it. Of course not. You're going to be incensed, aren't you, as a parent? Because that babysitter was your appointment to look after your child that evening, and your child should have heeded her instructions. You're going to be angry. You're going to be incensed. And Paul is saying that when people defy and disregard governments and authorities that he has appointed, and all governments and authorities have been appointed by him, then he is incensed. And Paul says at the end of verse 2, judgment will follow. In the first instance, I guess, he's talking about the government itself punishing that person for breaking the law. But of course, as will become clearer when we come to verse 4, and we've already actually mentioned it earlier, lying behind the government's punishment is the punishment of God himself. So that's the first thing, divine appointment. Second thing in these verses, divine work. Divine work in verses 3 and 4. Because Paul is aware, I think, that this picture that he has painted in verse 2 is a somewhat intimidating one. This picture of the states, the authorities coming down like a ton of bricks in judgment against those who have broken its laws. And that's why he immediately continues, therefore, in verse 3, rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right. So he's saying then to his readers who are perhaps trembling a little bit now, What if we fall prey to the judgment, the wrath of the state? He's saying to them, look, you don't need to run that risk. There's a very easy way of avoiding that possibility, a very easy way of avoiding the prospect of coming under the wrath of the authorities, and that's by doing right, by keeping the laws of the land. If you do that, Paul is saying, then you will be safe. And in fact, he adds at the end of verse 3, not only will you be safe if you do that, not only will you avoid punishment, but you will actually be, he says, commended, although commend isn't really a strong enough translation, it's literally praise. Do what is right, and he, that is the one in authority, will praise you. Because, you see, as Paul goes on to explain in verse 4, the state doesn't simply have a negative function. Of course, it does have a negative function. It is, as Paul says at the end of verse 4, an agent of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. But the state also, Paul says at the beginning of verse 4, has a positive function. The positive function of commending, of praising you when you do good. Although, I think how that should really be translated at the beginning of verse 4 is, he is God's servant to encourage you to do good. So it has this positive function of encouraging men and women to do good. So he's saying then that the state doesn't simply have this kind of perversely single-minded obsession with punishing people, with locking people up and with executing people. But it also is passionate about encouraging good behavior in people. And the underlying reason why that is so, he goes on to say in verse 4, is because, you see, God is in the business of both those things. The reason why the state has this twin function, this dual purpose of both punishing bad behavior and encouraging good behavior, is because God is in the business of those two things. He punishes bad behavior and he encourages good behavior. And it's therefore as God's servant, he says quite explicitly, not on his own behalf, but as God's servant, that the ruler punishes bad behavior. And it's as God's servant, not on his own behalf, but on God's behalf, that the ruler encourages good behavior. In punishing bad behavior and encouraging good behavior, the rulers are doing God's work. They're doing God's work on his behalf. He is into those two things. That's his business. And when rulers are doing that, they are doing God's work. So, God's appointment, God's work. But then thirdly, God's requirement. Because, and this is in verses 5 to 7, because then in verse 5, Paul concludes, doesn't he? Therefore, it is necessary to submit to the authorities. He's just reiterating what he said actually in the very opening words of the passage. Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities. But now we're a few verses down the line, and this requirement, this obligation, has the weight of solid arguments behind it, doesn't he? Doesn't it? And he summarizes what those arguments are in verse 5. First of all, we should submit for a pragmatic reason, because of punishment. If we don't submit to the authorities, we'll be punished by them. They'll lock us up. They'll come down on us in judgment. But then secondly, on the basis of principle, not only because of possible punishment, but also because of conscience, he says. In other words, because if we don't submit to them, we're acting unethically. If we don't submit to the authorities, we're acting unethically, because the authorities are God's appointment and they're doing God's work. And then in verses 6 and 7, having stated then this requirement that we submit, we have to submit. In verses 6 and 7, he fleshes out a little what that submission looks like. And he basically in these verses just applies Jesus' principle, doesn't he? You all know Jesus' principle. Give to God what is God's and to Caesar what is Caesar's. And that's what he's applying in verses 6 and 7. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's. He says in verse 6 that you already are doing that if you're paying taxes. You're giving to Caesar what is Caesar's. But then in verse 7, he extends it to other areas. And he says, yes, do it in the area of taxes, but do it in other areas as well. If you owe him revenue, if you If you owe the authorities revenue, he's probably there meaning, in distinction from taxes, he's meaning a specific one-off fees for services that the government perform. If you owe the government revenue, then pay it. If you owe the government respect, then pay it. If you owe the government honor, then pay it. Submit in these ways. That is your requirement. So those are the three things then that Paul brings out in these verses. Divine appointment, that government per se, not some kinds of government, but government per se is the appointment of God, the powers that actually be. Divine work, that governments in punishing bad behavior and encouraging good behavior are actually doing God's work. They're his servants in that. And then divine requirement. The requirement is that we submit, therefore. We submit to the authorities. But as we close then, perhaps you're thinking, hang on a minute, Paul. Hang on a minute. You're not living here in the real world. You're painting such a rosy picture of governments and states and authorities. Paul, you're being hopelessly idealistic. Because this isn't how it is in the real world. In the real world, governments are corrupt and self-seeking and godless and immoral. Paul, you just don't take account of that here in this passage. I'm sorry, Paul. What you've said about the gospel, about redemption in chapters 1 to 11 is profound and wonderful and moving. And your ethics in chapter 12 are penetrating and challenging. But here in the first part of chapter 13, I'm afraid you're a bit out of touch. You're out of touch with reality. Well, before we jump to that conclusion, perhaps we should remind ourselves of two or three things. For one thing, remember, Paul experienced more than most people do, mistreatment by authorities and governments, simply for preaching the gospel, simply for preaching the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Paul was on more than one occasion flogged and on more than one occasion imprisoned. He knew what the inside of a prison cell looked like. Paul experienced more than most mistreatment by authorities. Then for another thing, remember that Paul wasn't above taking the authorities to task for their mistreatment. It's a very contemporary debate, isn't it? How long you can detain someone without trial. Well, we know of two occasions at least in the book of Acts where Paul took the authorities to task for detaining him and for punishing him without a fair trial. And then, for another thing, there's the fact that Paul was part of a Christian church, which from a very early point, from its earliest point, had articulated the principle that sometimes obedience to God must be at the expense of obedience to governments and authorities. You can read about it in Acts chapter 4. We must obey God rather than men. Sometimes the two come into conflict, the precepts of God and the precepts of the state. And in that case, the church was very clear from an early point, from even earlier than Paul himself was converted, it was very clear that God must be obeyed rather than men. So I don't think we can jump to the conclusion that Paul was naive, that Paul wasn't living in the real world, that he was out of touch with reality. Because for one thing, Paul was mistreated by governments more than most. And for another thing, Paul was quite willing to take authorities to task about their mistreatment. And then for another thing again, Paul was part of a church that prioritized obedience to God over obedience to men. And so acknowledged that sometimes the state is simply in the wrong and simply cannot be obeyed. Well, why then is none of that reflected in this passage here? And I think the answer to that question is that Paul wants to emphasize here and wants to remind us here that practically all governments, however corrupt, however self-seeking, however godless, however immoral, even those governments which throw a man like him into prison for preaching the gospel, and which sometimes have to be taken to task, and which sometimes even have to be obeyed by conscientious Christians. Even those governments, do, to some degree, usually to a significant degree, punish bad behavior and encourage good behavior. You think about it. You think of a part of the world today where Christians are being persecuted. And you go to a prison in that place. And in that prison, you will find Christians. People like Paul who are in prison simply because they've been preaching the gospel. And that, of course, is outrageous. It's atrocious. It's abhorrent. But, of course, you will most likely also find in that same prison people who are there because they have robbed and because they have committed sexual offenses and because they have murdered and because they have been frauds. And Paul is saying then that in punishing those people, in putting those people in prison, that government, that state, has been doing God's work, regardless of the fact that it has also thrown Christians into prison. And of course, it will one day have to answer to God for that, and that is atrocious, and that is unjustifiable and indefensible. But insofar as it has punished genuine wrongdoers, it has been doing God's work. And you can't therefore just write off that state, that authority. You can't just write it off because of the unjustifiable and the indefensible things it has done. Insofar as it has punished bad behavior and encouraged good behavior, it has been doing God's work. And as I say, that then applies to practically all governments, practically all authorities. You go to the very worst, the most depraved government of all in our world today. And even there, most likely, you will find that to some extent, it is punishing genuine wrongdoers and even perhaps encouraging and praising genuine good behavior. And Paul would say that insofar as it's doing that, it's doing God's work. In those other areas, of course, it's not. And as I say, we'll have to answer to God for that. But insofar as it is punishing and praising, then it is doing God's work. And I think that this is very relevant for us today, because many of us, I'm sure, are often dismayed, aren't we, at trends in our government and trends in our rulers, dismayed by the ideas they come up with, the announcements they make, the laws that they propose. And we may well take them to task on that, writing letters to members of parliament and so on. And that's good. Paul, as we've seen, took authorities to task. And we may well also prepare ourselves, psychologically at least, spiritually perhaps, for possible civil disobedience at some point, for having to actually go against the government because it is going against God. And again, that's good, that's fine. Paul did that as well. Or at least Paul was part of a church, as we've seen, that was fully in favor of that. But what we must not do is allow cynicism to develop. Because Paul didn't do that. Paul did not allow cynicism against authorities to develop. And Romans 13, verses 1 to 7, is a monumental testament to that. That he could write so glowingly of governments insofar as they are punishing wickedness and encouraging good. And we must beware, I think, of a cynicism developing, whereby whenever the government makes an announcement on economics, we sneer and we deride and we mock simply because we don't like the government's views on homosexuality. Even though its views on homosexuality have nothing whatsoever to do with what it's saying about economics. Or when the government makes an announcement on national security, we sneer and we mock and we deride, because we don't like the government's views on abortion, even though its views on abortion have nothing to do with what it's saying about national security. We must beware, I think, that cynicism. Paul says that we owe to government taxes and revenue. I don't suppose many of us are tempted even to withhold taxes and revenue from the government. But he says we also owe the government respect and honour. And perhaps many of us this morning are tempted sometimes to withhold that, tempted to treat the government in across the board, in all its operations, in all its spheres, tempted to treat it with disrespect, with sneering words, and to laugh and scorn and to generally speak in a very low way about it. But Paul is saying we owe respect and honour. And Romans 13 is showing that Paul, even Paul so often in prison, Paul so often flogged, even he was able to give it that respect and honour, even in that corrupt Roman world in which he lived. And we must make sure this morning that we are being diligent in that, in paying respect and honour where it is due. Amen.